Microsoft buys Skype for $8.5 billion.
The company wants to go deeper into the internet video and voice market.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. Thanks for checking out the podcast, the Marketplace Midday Update at marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, May 10th. Coming up, China sees a big trade surplus that probably has something to do with us.
A German stock trader who turned in his broker card for a pair of tongs and a grill.
And the new meaning to the term farming until the cows come home. All that and more ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplace.
A big buyout's been announced this morning that's going to make for some big ripples in the tech world.
Yeah, the software behemoth Microsoft is buying Internet phone network Skype for $8.5 billion. It's the biggest pickup for Microsoft in the company's 36-year history. Marketplace's David Gura explains.
With Skype, you can video chat and make phone calls over the Internet.
They were the brand that pioneered this.
That's Kara Swisher, executive editor of All Things Digital. She says Microsoft probably wants to integrate Skype into its software and search engine, into its video game console and its mobile phones. But Rupert Goodwins, the editor of the tech website ZDNet UK, suspects there's something else at play.
It could also be a desperate move by Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft, to pull together one big deal that actually makes sense. He's come under a lot of criticism recently.
For ceding a lot of ground to competitors, including Google and Apple, Goodwins says Microsoft may just want to bring Skype's users on board, but he wonders how much they're really worth.
There are 660 million people who use Skype, but most of them will already be Microsoft users, so they won't be new to Microsoft.
But the company's been trying to focus more on big business, and some analysts say the Skype deal could open the door to the corporate video conferencing market. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Well, let's get reaction now to the Microsoft Skype deal from Henry Blodgett. He's the CEO of Business Insider, and he joins us now. Henry, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what would Skype give Microsoft?
Microsoft is under attack on many different fronts. One is Facebook and Apple and Google in communications, video, everything else. Skype is a very well-known brand. It was the pioneer in voice over IP, where people can talk to each other over their computers. It would give them hundreds of millions of users and a very strong brand in an area in which they are under attack.
And you mentioned Facebook and Google. Are those the companies that Microsoft sees as its competitors these days?
Increasingly, yes. You go back about 10 years, Microsoft pretty much owned email with Exchange and Office. And since then, Facebook is now where people are really setting up shop. We used to open up our computers and Windows was our base of operations. Now, increasingly, people are spending their days working from Facebook. Anything that Microsoft can do to get back in between people and Facebook and their friends and everything else is good. And I think that's part of what they're seeing in Skype.
Now, this sounds like a big deal. We hear $8.5 billion floating around. But for a company like Microsoft, is this really that big of an acquisition?
It's certainly not as big as it would be for you or me or any normal company. Microsoft is a company with almost $50 billion of cash sitting on its balance sheet. It has about $15 billion of free cash that it generates every year. So it's not huge, but at the same time, it's not couch change either. $8 billion is a big price tag.
Henry Blodgett, CEO of Business Insider, thanks as always.
Thank you.
A Senate subcommittee will hear testimony today from Apple and Google executives on cell phone tracking technology. Now, congressional members want more information on that technology, like which businesses might be interested in knowing where you've been and when you've been there. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The hearing comes after news that iPhones were tracking users' movements and storing the data for up to a year. This is valuable information. Your health insurance company, for instance, might be interested in knowing if you went to the gym or a candy store. Jeff Chester heads the Center for Digital Democracy.
Other companies can collect this data and then use it to make determinations about what you may pay for insurance or whether even, in fact, to hire you for a job.
Mark Rotenberg heads the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He says Congress should require companies to delete cell phone location data immediately.
If someone does a GPS search on their local movie theater, they get back the information they needed, and that would be a very good moment to actually delete the data.
Rotenberg commended Apple for moving quickly to make some changes. iPhones are now only supposed to store location data for a week. We contacted Apple and Google. Apple referred us to its website. It says personal security and privacy are important. Google says it looks forward to, quote, engaging with policymakers. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer from Marketplace.
The low-cost European carrier EasyJet said while passenger traffic was up, its losses more than doubled in the last 3 months. Caesars Entertainment, meanwhile, reported a small loss in its first quarter, blamed on flooding in Illinois and Indiana that closed some of its properties.
Wendy's Arby's Group is out with earnings this morning as well, and the company's reporting a loss because of the rising cost of ingredients. But sales at Arby's actually rose a few percent.
And no word, Steve, this morning on what's going to happen to Arby's, which
they sell
the Wendy's
right.
Arby's group, yeah, says it wants to sell. For more numbers, you know where to go. The numbers section at marketplace.org.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles. For a free audiobook of your choice, including In the Plex by Stephen Levy or The New Frugality by Chris Farrell, go to audiblepodcast.com/marketplace.
Now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. China today reported a hefty trade surplus for April, more than $11 billion. Now, that country manufactured and shipped more of its goods around the world while importing a bit less. That's pointing to strong global demand for Chinese products, but there are also some other factors playing into these numbers. Gareth Leather is with the Economist Intelligence Unit, and he's with us from London this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
How much of this has to do with the fact that China is keeping its currency values down?
Certainly it's got something to do with it, but if you take April's figures, but for the first 4 months as a whole, you've actually seen China's trade surplus fall compared with previous years. And so from the Chinese perspective, they can certainly kind of point to this fact when they're having discussions with the Americans about the value of their currency, but certainly the fact that China does run arguably an undervalued currency has something to do with the size of China's trade surplus.
I want to talk about those talks that you were speaking of between U.S. and Chinese officials in Washington. How is this news going to affect what's being said there?
I mean, it's obviously not good timing for the Chinese that they'd have been hoping, you know, ideally for the trade surplus to be a lot fuller or possibly free or there even to be a deficit as there has been for the first quarter of the year. So it's not ideal timing, but I think that the Chinese and also the Americans recognize that 1 month's worth of data can be quite volatile, and it's important to not to read too much into just 1 month's figures.
Gareth Leather at the Economist Intelligence Unit, thank you so much.
Pleasure, thank you.
Let's get another perspective now on China's big trade surplus. Julie Neiman is an analyst with Smith Moore & Company, and she's with us as she is every Tuesday from St. Louis. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Jeremy.
So inflation is high in China. That means the costs of the things that it make, the cost to make those things that it produces goes up. So why would exports be rising now instead of falling?
Well, in spite of everything, even with wages and commodities going up in China, they are still the lowest cost producer. So they ended up with exports up 30% in spite of those higher prices, imports up only 22%. Now, the U.S. wants China to raise the value of the yuan, too, because a cheaper yuan enables them to underbid and underprice all of their trading partners. And we'll also mumble about human rights because they're concerned over the Arab Spring could spread to their shores, too. But China has very legitimate concerns. We need to get our fiscal mess under control. We pay them in dollars, and they buy tons of treasuries, and both are going down in value due to our inability to get our debt and spending under control, and they view this as the big ripoff, not the big payoff. So we have real testy conditions going on with China at the point, and we also appear to be in a shift with Pakistan. China has always been a long supporter of Pakistan because they both hate India, and we're clouding our relations with Pakistan, so we've got two things that are clouding problems with China right now.
And these big meetings are going on in Washington with high-level Chinese officials. Julie, quickly, do you expect anything big to come out of these meetings?
Mostly they're going to say that we have strong cooperation and growing cooperation. But again, the key thing is going to be, can we make any headway with this? They're not going to give until they see us have some significant movement on the debt.
Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company. Thanks as always.
You bet.
This week, we also got word about Germany's trade surplus, which surged in March, fueled by record exports for the month. The German government said exports and imports were at their highest levels in that country since 1950.
That's helping a recovering economy that's expected to grow almost 3% this year. Quite a turnaround from the days of the financial crisis when the economy was tanking and people were losing their jobs.
Yeah, one German man who was laid off during the recession decided to trade in his stockbroker cap for a chef's hat. From Frankfurt, Caitlin Carroll dishes out the details.
Thomas Braus lost his job as a stockbroker during the height of the financial crisis. He decided to take a risk and invest $80,000 opening a lunch stand. Now Braus serves bankers and construction workers sausages named after the major indices, like the DAX, the Nikkei, and the barbecue-flavored Dow Jones. It's a dream he's had for a while.
Because we are just 250 meters away from my old office, and I saw the need of having a snack point like that, offering typical German food.
He named it the Frankfurt Sausage Exchange. It's fitting for a lunch counter that sits in the shadow of one of Frankfurt's tallest banking buildings, where Braus used to work as a trader.
The business I would call delivery against payment business. So I deliver the shares and get the payment in. That's maybe the only thing which is comparable to the new job, because I deliver the French fries and the sausage and I get the money in. Yeah, but it's more real.
Braus says it's tough going, but he doesn't regret his decision, especially when he sees the stress on the faces of his former colleagues in the financial world.
The pressure to the firms, to the owner of firms, to the people, employees working for them, is still the same. And so I don't see that the very good times are back.
Thomas Hübner takes a break from his high-pressured portfolio management job. He's a big fan of the currywurst here. That's a combination of sausage, ketchup, and spices.
I think it's one of the best here in Frankfurt.
He says Thomas Braus's decision to go from stocks to sausages makes a lot of hungry bankers happy.
Yeah, from this point of view, I'm one of the winners of the financial crisis.
And if Braus's business continues to grow, then so is he. In Frankfurt, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
There is a slideshow, by the way, of Braus's place. Pictures that are, wow, mouthwatering, amazing, at marketplace.org. Check it out.
Well, passenger numbers and profit are both up at the Middle East airline Emirates, a carrier that's been expanding very rapidly. It's been buying a lot of new aircraft, and Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports the airline is going to be in the market for some experienced pilots to fly them.
Emirates Airlines says it plans to add 30 planes to its fleet every year for the next 5 years. All of those planes will need pilots, and a lot of them could come from the U.S. George Hamlin is an aviation industry consultant.
A pilot with qualifications to fly on large jet aircraft is literally a global commodity now. You don't have to work in your own country.
Smaller countries like Singapore and Dubai have to recruit internationally because they don't have big militaries or civil aviation networks to draw from. Sam Scanlon runs a website called jsfirm.com, which is a job board for the aviation industry. He says he's been seeing growing demand for pilots in the Middle East and Asia.
That's led to a lot of individuals going to these areas. They generally can make more money, and it's just added to the problem of the shortage of pilots.
He says he hasn't seen U.S. airlines trying to match offers from foreign carriers yet. But if airlines like Emirates keep expanding, they may have to. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Well, we're coming up on graduation season, which means it's business plan competition time at the nation's business schools. From Harvard to Rice to the University of Chicago, student entrepreneurs have been honing their elevator pitches. MIT holds its final round tomorrow. From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman has our report.
This year, for the first time, contestants in MIT's pitch competition were able to submit their startup ideas not just on paper and in person, but also in 60-second videos on YouTube. MBA student Kurosh Kagazian is running the contest.
It's really important for startups that have limited resources to be able to use social media platforms to sort of promote their products or services, to recruit talent or raise funding.
YouTube opened up this year's field beyond the elite East Coast MBA network of MIT, Harvard, Wharton, and the like. Video pitches came from Georgia Tech, the University of Utah, also Taiwan, Cameroon, India, and Pakistan. Kagazian says there's an art to this 60-second elevator pitch. It's got three key ingredients, and we'll mash up some of the YouTube videos to demonstrate. First, there's the problem.
Everyone produces earwax, but for 35 million Americans, their wax buildup is so large that it plugs the ear canal, causing symptoms such as hearing loss and ringing in their ears.
We provide access to high-end exotic automobiles for a fraction of the cost of ownership.
Holy crap. 2.5 billion people lack access to adequate sanitation in the developing world.
Next ingredient, how your solution works in the marketplace.
With our patent-pending earwax removal system, nurses can see into the ear canal while injecting water, thus avoiding complications like
second-by-second, tenth-of-a-page resolution analytics about
banana fiber.
Banana fiber. Okay. Finally, no elevator pitch is complete without a closer, something catchy to seal the deal.
And we're going to revolutionize education.
Help us as we turn into gold.
No messy cleanup. It's quicker, it's safer, it's easier.
That last pitch you heard, by the way, for Clear Ear, the earwax removal startup, it won the beauty contest on YouTube. Tomorrow night, its student team from MIT and Stanford will compete against a dozen other finalists for MIT's $100,000 prize. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And you can check out some of the YouTube videos that were submitted for this year's MIT Elevator Pitch Contest at marketplace.org.
And finally, Steve, to the nation's heartland, where farmers are really feeling the high gas prices. So according to the New York Times, a growing number of them are switching from tractors to oxen to farm their land.
What?
Like the good old days. Well, the nice thing is these animals, they run on grass.
Not gas,
which is a little cheaper. They also fertilize the land, of course.
Yes.
And they're cuter than tractors,
yes,
in my opinion.
Sure.
Though one expert tells the Times, in the summer heat, don't expect them to do much work. They will be more than happy to go into park mode.
More like a mule.
That's right. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.